You know, they had a speech written for me about what the people need. But you guys are the people. You know what you need. Better schools. Better jobs. Less crime. How many of you right now work two jobs just to have enough money to be broke? That ain't right. If you work two jobs and at the end of the week you got just enough money to get your broke ass home, let me hear you say, that ain't right. How many of you have children that they call stupid? Don't be ashamed. It ain't your fault. I asked my niece the other day, what's 4 plus 4? She said 44.
It is.
So that ain't her fault. That's the school's fault. Now, if your child's school has old-ass books and brand-new metal detectors, let me hear you say, that ain't right.
That ain't right.
It ain't right. And now we got these corporations stealing all the money. They stealing their money. They stealing our money. The pension. You worked for 35 years. You thought you was going to leave your kids a will. Now you're going to leave them a won't. You show up to get your pension, they give you a pen. Give you a damn pen. Now what the hell am I supposed to do with a pen? I should just stab you in the neck with this pen, Mr. Pension Taker.
Get your hand out of my pocket.
Taking everybody's pension and nobody going to jail.
That's some bullshit. That's some bullshit.
Meanwhile, you are. We steal a Big Mac with cheese. Next thing you know, we on death row. How many of you work in a city you can't afford to live in? That ain't right. How many of you work in a mall that you can't afford to shop in? That ain't right. How many of you clean up a hotel you ain't never gonna be able to stay in? That ain't right. And we got nurses that work in hospitals that they can't even afford to get sick in. It ain't right. It ain't right. It ain't right. It isn't right. That shit is wrong. It's bad wrong.
Hey everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. On this episode of Indirect Democracy, it's all about the race. Plus, we'll be having a blog post even about the fur, we'll have global warming updates, we'll have the President's Love Horoscope, a brand new sponsor, and of course, the What a Weenie Award. And welcome! Welcome to podcast number 32 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David. And welcome. This is it. We are now in full swing. The debates are going on. The conventions are over. The stump speeches are in full blast. My God, are they in full blast. And it is time. 24 days as of this time of recording, until November 4th, 2008, Election Day, and the brand new start of a different era in our history. Thank God for that. There's going to be a lot to talk about, and I'm just going to jump right into what we have to get into with the global warming update. Now, as many of you know, I do like to give news stories about global warming and how it affects different parts of our lives. And before people go, what the heck is he talking about? I found this story that just made me kind of crack up a bit, because I believe, like the great Mike Myers has once said, that most Scottish food, in fact, probably a lot of Scottish things, are based upon a dare. So, with that in mind, here is this global warming update. The story is entitled, Haggis at Risk from Global Warming. Let's see, dated August 10th, 2008. Haggis is at a risk of dying out due to global warming. The meat pudding is known to children as a rare tartan creature found only in the highlands, but the rise of the common parasite lungworm, which is thriving due to global warming, is putting it at risk. Haggis, in case you are not aware of this, is made from a sheep's stomach, which is stuffed with oatmeal and minced intestines. But butchers are finding it more and more difficult to get a hold of the principal ingredient of sheep's lung, as so many of them are infected with lungworm. Dr. Sandy Clark, the veterinary center manager at the Scottish Agricultural College in Thurso, said the parasite was thriving because it is able to survive in grazing all year round in the warmer climates. Although lungworm will not necessarily show up in a healthy sheep or affect all the meat, it will make the lungs of an animal unfit for human consumption. Lungworm has been at a very low level and did not cause serious problems in sheep, but with the changing climate and availability of the parasite, it is becoming a problem. The sad fact is that the disease is causing the lungs to be condemned for human consumption. Joe Finley, owner of Finley's Butcher Shop in Edinburgh, said it was a struggle to source lung from Scottish farms, so butchers are turning to Ireland instead. The award-winning butcher said that the growing demand for haggis across the world was because of the fashion for societies dedicated to Scottish poet Robert Burns and the fact that the Scottish diaspora was also making it more difficult to source the ingredients. It could well get worse. We are just keeping our fingers crossed. Now, the majority of out there right now are thinking, what the hell is haggis made from again? And you're right. I've never eaten it. Don't want to eat it. Sounds horrible. But there are a lot of people that love it. And I like to bring up stories like this. And I know many of you are going, flooding! The destruction of the world! Hurricanes! Katrina! Ike! It's all going to hell! But while it's all going to hell, can't we just realize that sometimes it's the little things that make people stand up and go, wait a minute. That actually affects me? That's where I think the Global Warming Update has its good nature, just to talk about little things, obscure things that make people go, huh, that is affecting. And on occasion, when there's a really big story, I promise I will bring it up. But every now and then, I feel that we just need to have a little levity and sometimes a slight reality check with what we talk about when it comes to global warming, because it's the little things when they start to add up that make people realize that it does affect them now. So that was your global warming update. I just realized as I was going into this that I did not mention that Indirect Democracy is a proud member, a very, very proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. You can find the Progressive Podcast Network at progressivepodcastnetwork.org or their forum site at newmediarevolutionaries.com. Yes, still a very, very proud member, and I apologize for not mentioning that at the beginning. But since I am trying to get through a whole bunch of stuff and a lot of work, I am now going to get into the President's Love Horoscope. Let's see, I just need to find the right music for this. Hold on. Bringing up the music. Oh, yeah. There it is. Now, as many of you know, in an attempt to help out our president, I like to read to him his horoscope. Now, as we all know, our president is in fact a Cancer. So, here it is, Mr. President, with the music playing in the background and the voice kicking in. It is time to read you your presidential horoscope. From the fine pages of Elle magazine. Your love meter reading is an 8. You hear it, Mr. President? Because for this week, you have very, very tender feelings. Everyone that knows you well understands this. And your feelings are easily bruised early this week, but luckily restore themselves before midweek. Now, Mr. President, are your feelings hurt because of how people are criticizing you about the economy? Is that it, Mr. President? What does it bother you when you're gonna go home to Crawford soon? Home to feel the love that's there for you, Mr. President. But, Mr. President, once you get through Monday, the remainder of the week promises new alliances. Oh, yeah. Touch them new alliances. Better connections, Mr. President. Oh, yeah. Better connections with existing friends and loved ones. And a lot more hope that helps your self-esteem. your weekly touchstone for this week are
Molly Knights
and Awkward Justin. And that is your love horoscope for this week. Okay, now that that's over, before we get into our first topic, here is an ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
In a world where hippies live amongst mortal men, comes a podcast like no other. Excretions from multiple orifices are to be expected. Bring your towel. The Lifted Lorax Show brings you politics, life, and a wide stance like no other podcast can bring you. All downloaded conveniently into a large shopping bag. Visit The Lifted Lorax Show at theliftedloraxshow.podomatic.com for all your colorectal needs.
Well, one of the topics I've been neglecting over the past year or so has been the subject of Darfur. Now, as a MySpace member, I do subscribe to the blogs of Maria Helena, and I read one of her postings a long time ago, and I wanted to read one that she put up recently because it does pertain to presidential politics, and this one is entitled, Palin Team Opposed Divesting of Holdings to Protest Darfur. This was posted on Sunday, October 5th. And here is the story, with beginning quote from Sarah Palin during the vice presidential debate of October 2nd. When I and others in the legislature found out we had some millions of dollars in Sudan, we called for divestment through legislation of those dollars to make sure we weren't doing anything that would be seen as condoning the activities there in Darfur. Don't you know? I had to add that in, I'm sorry. Sarah Palin suggested that she was at the forefront of a campaign in Alaska to sell stocks and companies to do business with Sudan, in protest against the mass killing of civilians in the western part of the country. But the record shows that her administration was against the divestiture movement before it was for it. The facts. The Save Darfur Coalition has been urging states to divest of stocks from companies that do business with Sudan for the last 2 years, arguing that the investments help fund genocide. An Alaska Saving Fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund, has about $22 million invested in international trading companies such as China Petroleum and Alstom of France to do business with Sudanese oil interests. Alaska Permanent Fund officials made clear from the outset that they were opposed to any divestiture effort. Executive Director Mike Burns told an Anchorage TV station, KTUU, on December 11 that the fund was looking for the best return on investments and never took into account socially responsible investments, whether it's tobacco or alcohol or hospitals to perform abortions or hospitals that don't perform abortions. Last January, a bill known as HB 287 was introduced into the Alaska House of Representatives to restrict investments in companies that do business with Sudan. During a committee hearing in February, a Palin administration representative, Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Andrews, testified against the legislation on the grounds that it would do nothing to help the afflicted in Sudan and would add to the fund's administrative costs. While acknowledging that the legislation was well-intended and that the desire to make a difference is noble, Andrews warns that mixing moral and political agendas at the expense of our citizens' financial security is not a good combination. A co-sponsor of the legislation, Anchorage Democrat Les Garra, said that Palin apparently had a change of heart on the divestiture issue in March. During a brief hallway conversation, she expressed sympathy for his bill. By that time, however, the bill had effectively died in committee. The change in Palin administration's position became official in April when Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin announced that the administration supported a Senate bill on divestment SB 227 as a proactive action against genocide in Darfur, saying, "The situation is an ongoing human tragedy and Alaska has an opportunity to take a stand against those activities." The Senate bill, like the House bill, went nowhere, as there was no time to take action on it before the legislature wrapped up its business in early April. The Pinocchio test of this. Sarah Palin is exaggerating her role in leading the Sudan divestiture in Alaska. The legislative record shows that her administration was late in embracing the campaign to sell stock in companies to do business with Sudan, and that it initially opposed the divestiture. The Alaska Permanent Fund still invests in companies blacklisted by the Save Darfur Coalition. So that was the blog posting from Maria Helena's site. I encourage you to read more or subscribe to her blog postings if you are a MySpace member. You can find the link to her site through the homepage for Indirect Democracy. Just look in the favorite link section and you will find her site. And now, another ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
Hello, this is America's 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, a.k.a. Honest Abe, a.k.a. the Rail Splitter, a.k.a. President Feelgood, a.k.a. the Great Emancipator. Please, don't get up. I'm just a regular guy like you, only I'm like 20 feet tall, and my hands are so lean and work callous that they can serve as bladed weapons. My beard is really scratchy, which is not to say that I am unapproachable. A lot of people say to me, President Lincoln, aren't you dead? Well, I fix them with my trademark, steely, one-room log cabin glare and say, we're all dead if we don't start paying attention to how this country is run. And some guys will say, is that a threat? To those jokers, I really lay it on. The mole on my face sticks out about a quarter of an inch, so I turn my head a few degrees until it's pointing right at them. Freaks their game out. It's accusing. I say to them, that's not a threat, that's a promise. A promise to diligently scour the news and report items of note with a smooth, double malt Kentucky charisma. So if you're keen to hear a party independent voice that doesn't ignore the alternative news and takes the time to both analyze and lampoon the paid disinformation and propaganda of corporate news, visit theabrahamlincolnlogs.com. Listen via the browser or subscribe with your podcatcher of choice. Come on down. We're not hard to find. Keep going until you pass the Daily Cause, and when you get to the Huffington Post, turn left. This is Honest Abe Lincoln, and I'm proud to be a member of the Progressive Podcast Network.
Okay, so when I started this podcast, I said that the issue of the race, or the main focus on this, is that it was all about the race. But when I began to think about this piece or this particular portion of the podcast, I thought maybe it should be that this political season is all about fear. But in reality, let's come on. That's been done to death. 2002, 2004, 2006 played mostly upon fear. And it was the fear of us getting killed. It's simple, it's palpable, easily scripted. Think about it. You are gonna die. That's what they were telling you. If you vote that way, you're gonna die. So what's easier than the base fear of our very survival, the death itself, at least the threat of it itself? But as I was looking upon this political season, and I keep hearing the old taglines, each seems to begin with, it's all about. It's all about the economy. It's all about energy independence. It's all about job creation. It's all about health care. It's all about Iraq. It's all about climate change. And, of course, it's all about the Supreme Court. Now, I bring these up because these are the arguments I have presented to people I meet and talk to about the future, our future as a nation. And arguably, with everything that this nation is facing, this is easily the most important election of our times. And I know that's overstated, but there is no doubt that this election should be about our future. But I'm thinking about this, and I've thought about this a lot, and this is not any surprise to anybody. You're probably all going to go, duh. The truth is that we're pretty much haunted by our own shadows. It's the shadows of hatred, and yes, fear, of course. But despite it all, this election, the issue of it all, it's all about the race. Or should I be clear about it? It's all about race. It is race. That's all this election is about. It's race. Now, this is not surprising for some of you who are probably right now thinking, well, duh, just get on to the commercial or something. But let's just look at this from the stance of what should be important, and then in the end, what we keep coming back to. If it's all about the economy, that's it. That's the statement. Everybody looking at that now and saying, it's all about the economy. That should be the clincher. That one topic. That should be the one that should drive a stake into the unbeating dead heart of the Republican Party. Because face it, the economy is tanking big time. After nearly 30 years of supply-side economics based upon trickle-down theory from the top down, the only thing that has come to pass is that there has been a trickle-down. And that's if you count the rich pissing on the poor and the middle class as a trickle-down theory. Decades of work to undo the regulation started during the Great Depression to rein in rampant corruption was undone during this time to supposedly allow our economy to grow. The deregulation of investment banks, stocks, hedge funds that allowed for rampant speculation from everything from stocks, commodities, and even mortgage debt created profits in the debt speculation and trading of those debts for mortgages that were given not just to the poor and minorities that are so easily blamed for assuming debts that could not be handled, but in for allowing these loans to be based on no income, no job, or assets, or the so-called ninja loans that were given to persons whose sole purpose was sometimes used to flip property based upon the perception that property values would only rise and rise. Now, simple gravity alone tells you that everything that goes up has to come down. But this is how profits were made. It was made based upon the speculation of those debts. Now that everything's gone bust, oh, how easy it is. It's just so easy to blame the poor and the minorities. But the decision to create and continuously fund these loans and then profit from the debt created came from high up. And if you think otherwise, I have some very profitable swampland I want to sell you. I mean, think about it. In reality, you're not interested in any of that. Because you may not have a job soon because credit markets are shrinking. Or your 401k is gone due to failing stocks whose only profits exist on a spreadsheet that was tampered with by faulty accounting. Or you may not even have a home soon. But you don't care about that because the Democratic nominee's middle name, a name he did not choose and was given to him at birth, is Hussein. Well, maybe it's all about energy independence. We keep hearing this one over and over again, and this one also corresponds to our economy. The rising cost of fuel, especially diesel fuel, has increased the cost of every product and service we use. Hands down, this is a biggie. The food that we buy comes from trucks and trains that deal with the increase in fuel costs. Jet fuel costs are up, so it brings the cost of travel, or delivery of items by plane also goes up. I mean, look around at the store. Basic food costs rise while our paychecks stay the same. Fuel affects everything. Rampant speculation drove up the cost of a barrel based upon war, destabilization in the Middle East, hurricanes in the Gulf, events in Russia, Venezuela. Even a terse word between our government and Iran causes speculators to drive the cost of a barrel of crude way up. And while the cost of oil has decreased from $140 a barrel this past June to somewhere between $80 and $90 as of the time of this recording, according to the Wall Street Journal and MSNBC, this has only been a 35% decrease in the price of a barrel of crude. Now, let's look at the fall of a price of a gallon of gasoline. Here in California, the average right now is about $3.50. If we look back to around June, when it was about $4.85, $4.90, the average cost of houses has gone down to somewhere around 25%. We have a 10% discrepancy there. So, according to AAA, while the price of gasoline is about $3.50, 1 year ago, when the cost of a barrel of crude was around $78, according to MSNBC, the price of gas, according to AAA, was $3. Diesel was about $3.31, unlike the average price right now of $3.92. Are you seeing the differences here? The money that's being made? 92 cents difference price. The cost of a barrel of oil? Somewhere hovering between $80 and $90. It was $78 last year. Yet, gasoline cost on average about $3, and diesel was $3.31. Now, the average is about $3.50 for gasoline, and diesel is $3.92. Now, while the average family may have been able to afford their loans and mortgages, how can you afford them when the cost of gas, transportation, food, heating and oil, and every product and service that is touched by the cost of fuel goes up while our paychecks stagnate? How is it that the average person is supposed to make ends meet? The other side argues that the only way to bring down our energy costs, of course, is to drill into our own natural resources. But the argument to that fails to see what our own government knows. According to the Energy Information Administration, which does official energy stats for the government, the projections in the OCS, or Outer Continental Shelf, access case indicate that the access to the Pacific, Atlantic, and Eastern Gulf regions would not have a significant impact on domestic crude oil and natural gas production or prices before the year 2030. As Joe Biden would say, let me repeat that again, would have no significant impact on domestic crude oil and natural gas production or prices before 2030. Now, I've put links to these stories in the research section for Indirect Democracy if you'd like to find these. And let me continue on with just a portion from the story. Leasing would begin no sooner than 2012, 4 years from now, before they can even begin to touch these natural resources that everybody keeps saying drill, baby, drill about. And production would not be expected to start before 2017. Let's look at that again. They couldn't lease the land until 2012 and can't even begin to get any production out of it until 2017. Total domestic production of crude oil from 2012 through 2030 in the OCS, or Outer Continental Shelf Access case, is projected to be 1.6% higher than in the reference case and 3% higher in 2030 alone, at approximately 5.6 million barrels per day. For the lower 48, annual crude production in 2030 is projected to be 7% higher, or 2.4 million barrels a day, in the OCS, compared with the 2.2 million barrels per day in the reference case, which is they showed above. They show some graphs for this. Because oil prices are determined on an international market, any impact on average wellhead prices is expected to be insignificant. Now, although a significant volume of undiscovered, technically recoverable oil and natural gas resources is added in the OCS access case, conversion of those resources to production would require both time and money. In addition, the average field size in the Pacific and Atlantic regions tends to be smaller than the average that is found in the Gulf of Mexico, implying that a significant portion of the additional resource would not be economically attractive to develop at the reference case prices. What does all that mean in the end? It means that we're not going to see any oil until at least 2017, that by the time 2030 comes, that none of this is going to matter. For those of you who are paying attention, there is no immediate benefit to the cost of gasoline, the prices, anything as of now. This is nothing more than giving more stipends and more subsidies to the oil companies for a product that when they get their hands on it, if they get their hands on it, will do nothing to change the price of gas, even by 2030. There will be no difference. That's the point of this article. Now, the other side argues that, now, while there's no benefit to increased drilling except to keep the status quo wealthy, and haven't we had enough of that? At a time when our renewable resources could be used from wind to solar to even the use of biofuels to even just increase research in better fuel efficiency and simple conservation, God forbid we conserve energy, we fall under the shadow of increased drilling to save a problem for which the solution is never going to present itself. We will see no benefits in the immediate future, nor in the next generation. You know, we continue to talk about energy independence, yet we have learned nothing from countries like Brazil that use sugar-based biofuels to run their own cars. We've allowed Ford to send vehicles that can get up to 65 miles per gallon to be sold outside the United States, cars that could create thousands of jobs for Americans due to our hunger for fuel-efficient vehicles. But trust me, that is not what we are interested in, because once upon a time, Reverend Wright gave an angry sermon. Well, then it must all be about job creation. I mean, we all want and need new jobs. But the problem is we don't manufacture anything anymore. In this generation, we have watched Walmart become the nation's largest private employer, paying its employees lower wages with less benefits, while General Motors, GM, has fallen to eighth place over companies like McDonald's, Target, and Home Depot. You know, anything we could produce is produced outside the country, and even many service-related jobs like tech support are handled outside the country. We even have people traveling out of the country to obtain medical treatment and pharmaceuticals. but in a time when everything is claimed to be based upon a service-related industry or that service jobs will be the wave of the future, let me just give you a list of the largest retail employers that are closing their doors. Ann Taylor, closing 117 stores nationwide. Eddie Bauer closed 27 shops in the first quarter. Gap closed 86 stores throughout the country. Foot Locker, 140 stores. Wix Furniture has gone out of business, which is a shame because the wife and I, we love Wix Furniture. Levitt's, gone. The owner of Zales and Piercing Pagoda says it plans to close 82 stores by last July. Disney, the Disney store, has closed 98 stores throughout the country. Home Depot is closing stores throughout the country. CompUSA, closing stores. Macy's, closing 9 stores. Pep Boys, 33 stores. Sprint Nextel, 125 locations. JCPenney, Lowe's, and Office Depot are all scaling back. Wilson's, 158 stores. Ethan Allen Interiors announced plans to close 12 of 300-plus stores in an effort to cut costs. The Sharper Image, Bombay Company, closed. KB Toys and Dillard's, all closing stores or going out of business. So while they talk about the service-related industries and all the jobs that should exist there, the largest companies based upon service are going out of business. So while we could be looking at job creation that could be spurred on by a national jobs program that should be used to invest in alternative energy sources that could spur retail sales and new products or creation and retrofitting of roads, bridges, buildings that could spur growth in construction and other related industries from the purchase of new tools to work boots, even the hiring of architects, engineers, or insurance-related service to bond those jobs, we continue to bemoan those costs as too high. No, we won't create a national jobs program because those costs are too high. Because we don't have the money. We don't have the money for that, but somehow we have allowed the money to go on for massive bailouts to companies that are failing in industries that manufacture debt only. We bemoan the loss of Lehman Brothers, but do nothing to help out companies whose boss and employees are actually true-to-life brothers and sisters. We've mortgaged out our future and the costs of job creation type programs while we allow companies like AIG and its CEO, whose pay outmatch their employees by upwards of up to 350% of the average American's pay, to go on junkets at our expense. While according to news reports, AIG will be getting another $37 billion to add on to the $85 billion we already gave them. Oh, and all of that while we talk about the semantics of what we call this. Oh, it's the Main Street Rescue Plan. No, it is a Wall Street bailout. Stop calling it a rescue plan. It is a Wall Street bailout. Do not insult us after you've already ripped us off. The truth is, we can't even begin to create these job programs. We have no money for them. But we have all the money in the world for these failed companies. We have, to quote Randy Rhodes of Nova M Radio, privatized success and socialized failure. But that's the job market that faces us all. And what does any of that matter since Barack Obama served on an educational and poverty board with a 60s radical? Yep, Bill Ayers. You know, he did horrible stuff back in the 60s when Obama was only 8 years old. But what does any of that matter to you? Because, let's face it, you've got to get to your job at Walmart. You could say it's all about healthcare. I mean, this really is the predominant factor in all our lives because we all get sick. We have watched employees go on strike for better healthcare benefits, watched jobs go overseas to avoid paying for those benefits. We live a life where one injury or an emergency stay in a hospital can bankrupt a family. But what does John McCain care? He hasn't known a day where his health care wasn't paid for by the United States as the son of a military family, as an officer in our military, and then as a public servant as both a member of the House of Representatives and as a senator. During his entire lifespan, those 72 years, we have paid all of his medical expenses. So what does he offer us? A $2,500 tax credit. Now, so we all understand this, it's not a check to spend on health care. It's a tax credit when we go and buy our own. And it's also important to understand, because we all hear the $5,000 remark, that statement always thrown out there. This is from John McCain's own website, found at johnmccain.com. The health care benefits are $2,500 tax credit for individuals and $5,000 for families to offset the cost of the purchase of their own health care insurance. So, we all understand this. Here is the average cost of health insurance from the National Coalition on Health Care. The average cost for single-payer health coverage in the United States is about $4,400. McCain will cover that $2,500 of it, but first you have to pay upfront with your premiums for that health care. The average cost for a family of four in 2007 was $12,100, of which McCain will give you a tax credit after your premium payments of $5,000. Now, I know what many of you are thinking. I know, sure, it's better than nothing. But at an average rate hike of 6.9%, or twice the rate of inflation, to truly benefit, you will have to shop around for the cheapest insurance from companies and healthcare plans that I promise you are going to fight you at every turn for payment of any services. You know, sure, you can still try to stick with your employer's plan, but that's if you can find a good employer that will offer benefits. The sick little dirty secret of our economy and job creation itself is healthcare. We are the only remaining country in the Western world that does not offer a single-payer universal health plan to its citizens. But imagine if our country did offer a plan, any plan that would mirror this. Our country could benefit in ways outlined by this article from cthealth.com. Currently, 28 industrialized nations have a single-payer universal healthcare system. Of this, myth one is that the United States has the best healthcare system in the world. Currently, the United States ranks 23rd in infant mortality, down from 12th in 1960 and 21st in 1990. The United States ranks 20th in life expectancy for women, down from 1st in 1945 and 13th in 1960. The U.S. ranks 21st in life expectancy for men, down from 1st in 45 and 17th in 1960. The U.S. ranks between 50th and 100th in immunizations, depending on the immunization. Overall, the United States ranks 67th behind Botswana in immunizations. Fact 5. Outcome studies on a variety of diseases such as coronary artery disease and renal failure show the U.S. to rank below Canada and a wide variety of industrialized nations. The conclusion? The U.S. ranks poorly relative to other industrialized nations in healthcare. Now, this article, there's plenty more to this article. I'm going to link it at the research page for podcast number 32 of Indirect Democracy, and I encourage you to go read it. But in thinking about this again, all these issues about healthcare, everything that could be done, including the saving of jobs, think about it. Every strike that you have seen most recently deals with the issue of healthcare. Proper healthcare could help save this economy and the jobs that could be kept here and bring back manufacturing in the United States. But once again, what does that matter to you when the Democratic candidate for the presidency once lived in Indonesia and attended a school that was not, I repeat, not a madrasa? But since madrasa is a scary word, ooh.
It's up to you.
What'll we do? Well, it's up to you.
You know, it ain't that funny. You contribute all my money. You make your contribution, then you get your solution. As long as you can pay, I'm gonna do it all your way. Yes, money talks and the people walk. You. Now let me hear you say it. Big money.
Oh, big money! Big money!
Big money! Big money! Big money! Big money! Big money! Big money!
Real. The name of our game is Let's Make a Deal. Now people got their problems, the haves and the have not, but the ones that make me listen pay for 30 seconds pops.
30 seconds.
Yeah.
Joe Bank of America, this table over here, Wells Fargo and Citibank, you really very dear. Loan billions to Mexico and never have to fear, because taxpayers, take it in the rear.
Take it in the rear.
Yo, over here, we got our friends from oil. They don't give a shit how much wilderness is spoiled.
They tell us that the chemicals, we know that it's a lot. As long as we keep driving cars, they let the planet die.
Let the planet die, let the planet die.
Exxon,
Mobil, the salt is in Kuwait. If we still got the Middle East, the atmosphere can wait.
The Arabs got the oil, we buy everything they sell.
But if the brothers raise the price, we blow them all to hell.
Now let me hear you say it. Saddam.
Saddam.
Hussein.
Hussein.
Saddam.
I want you to give me a phone number. Dr. Morris Fishman, UCLA. He's at the Department of Psychiatry. Go, get the number now. Get it now.
Yo,
go.
Everybody gonna get sick someday, but nobody know how they gonna pay.
Healthcare, managed care, HMOs.
Ain't gonna work, no sir, not those. Cause the thing that's the same in every one of these motherfuckers there, the insurance companies.
Insurance.
Call it single payer, a Canadian way. Only socialized medicine will ever save the day. Come on now, let me hear that dirty word. Socialism!
No, no,
yeah,
no,
yeah.
No, no.
Now the women in the world is mistreated and abused, but when we try to fix it, we tend to get confused. I got respect for all the sisters, they will tell you that for style. But there's one thing in politics that always makes me smile. I like the pussy, the pussy. I like it really fine. And when you be a senator, you get it all the time. The young ones, the old ones, I really like them all. And when you be in Washington, you hardly have to call. The women, they love power. And if you don't pull that rug out, no matter what they say or do, they get you nappy dug out. Yeah.
Now, would we be eligible?
I just felt we needed a break, but let's get back to the subject. Now, of course, it's all about Iraq. We continue to lose $10 billion a month in Iraq. We can't leave the situation because it's bad, and we can't leave the situation because it's improving. We've hired out tens of thousands of contractors to do work that Iraqis could do after 5 years, but still there's no steady electricity in Baghdad, and running water is at a premium. In the Kurdish regions of Iraq, they fly their own flag, and will not accept any monies printed from the Iraqi government. They are in all shape and form a de facto country. And if you don't believe me, go to krg.org. The Iraqi government can only exist inside the Green Zone. We had to bribe Sunni and Shia factions as part of our strategy to quell the fighting for the surge to work. We have lost close to 4,200 Americans, injured over 30,000, and Fort found no weapons of mass destruction, have not funded any part of this war with Iraqi oil. We've created a new base for terrorist activity, lost the hearts and minds of Iraqis who see us as occupiers, and allowed the Iraqi government to gain a surplus of $80 billion, while we have bankrupted our futures to the tune of close to $1 trillion for a war that in the end, once it's all said and done, will cost us, according to economist Joseph Stiglitz, $3 trillion. To pay back. We lost our moral superiority in the world, lost any goodwill we gained after 9/11, and have failed to catch Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. To this date, we have only had one conviction based upon a military trial of any person who acted in league with al-Qaeda, and it was bin Laden's driver, who, according to news reports, Salim Hamdan was sentenced to time served, and even the judge himself requested his release within 6 months from the time of his sentencing last August, and even then gave him a blessing in Arabic. So if you can equate terrorism and Iraq, such as it's all about terrorism, then even there we have seen a global spike in terrorism, including an attack at a U.S. embassy last month that killed an American student. But John McCain and Sarah Palin know all about winning wars. Ask them. McCain served in Vietnam, but we lost that war, so that doesn't really count. We won Grenada. We won the first Persian Gulf War, and by golly, John McCain didn't serve in either of those two wars. And even though he supported the Persian Gulf War and the current Gulf War, he was a big proponent of the surge. I mean, that worked, right? You know, Sarah Palin herself will tell you that our troop levels have lowered since the surge, but she's wrong. If you look up the facts, our troop levels are still above pre-surge levels. So what does that matter to any of you? the fact that nothing has really gone right over there, that what we're being told are gigantic lies still. What does that matter to any of you? After all, you don't feel sure about Obama's ability to lead. You know, you just can't put your finger on it. You just get a strange feeling. So maybe it's all about climate change or global warming for you. You've seen the polar ice caps melting, the stronger and even stranger weather patterns, an increase in hurricanes and their strength, the destruction waged by Katrina, Rita, and even Hurricane Ike. You've felt muggier summers, warmer winters, less snow, permafrost melting, the loss of glaciers worldwide, the cracking and separation of Antarctica and Greenland. We've seen historic fires that have destroyed thousands of acres of wilderness that are bone dry due to no rain. We've seen the continued destruction caused by pollution in economically expanding regions like China and India, yet we seem to offer no leadership in technology or political will to curtail these effects. I mean, we've even witnessed the coming wars for the barest of our planet's water supplies. You know, we can see a future built around green technology, how it could spur new economic growth and a renewed spirit for this country. But it's a shame that John McCain does not believe in the use of ethanol to free up our need for petroleum as a fuel, or that Sarah Palin doesn't even believe that man is responsible for the effects caused by global climate change. We've seen the evidence and know the road to get to mitigating these effects. But why would we do that? I mean, didn't you know that Obama's wife made a verbal gaffe and said she wasn't proud of her country? I mean, how dare she say that? And we can even say that it's all about the Supreme Court. With Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Stevens, and Souter facing possible retirement within the next 4 years, we could see the loss of any so-called liberal judges to be replaced by more Sam Alitos and more Justice Roberts. We could see a court filled with judges that claim that the Constitution is not a living document and should be interpreted according to the original intent of men who, over 200 years ago, wrote it, knowing that its very survival as a document and our survival as a country would be based upon amending it. And we've done so 27 times over our brief existence. I mean, we changed the document to reflect changing times, but it doesn't live. It doesn't change. I just don't know. I mean, right now, as I speak, that document breathes within me and my First Amendment right to free speech and free expression. It lives in every right we have and in every freedom we enjoy and protects us and guides us when those rights are violated. Even when our own government fails to recognize those rights, it comes back to remind us as a nation of the right course. But we will lose those rights, even lose the sense of simple balance in a court that's decisions can last for generations based upon who sits at its bench. We may even lose the bread and butter decision that forges political careers called Roe v. Wade. I mean, come on. Do you really think the politicians want to lose this rallying point? I mean, for either side. I mean, no way. It keeps the base of both sides happy. But judges who have never known the struggle of a woman raped, or a person harmed by faulty workmanship, or what it's like to be wrongfully imprisoned, or to even have your home and property surveilled because of political expediency, will only think of an original intent that no longer exists. We have changed, will change, and only grow as a people. We have to. Because to not grow as a society, to not learn and change with society, technology, and see a brighter future will only condemn us to repeat our failures. But what does that matter to you? Bad economy, no jobs, high oil costs, no health care. We have no way out of Iraq. No way to solve climate change, and a Supreme Court that could turn truly conservative for generations to come. All these things that will affect the future. These are the progressive challenges of our century. But what does it matter if you feel that Obama can solve all this? Because face it, he's black. I mean, the issue is simple. Unfortunately, with just this small list of what ails our country, and our world, let's face it, our world, the simple and stupid thing about this race is that it's all about race. We could close our eyes and just listen to who is saying the right things. I mean, that's all we could do, is just close our eyes and listen to them. I mean, we could listen to that person who believes in what matters most to you. A person who was raised in a manner probably similar to you. But for many people, even people who are sickened to the core by 8 years of failed and often criminally negligent behavior. I bet you still know people who won't vote for Obama because he's black. Or adversely, will tell you that you are voting for him simply because he's black. I mean, is that part true? Yeah, maybe there are some people out there who want him to become president solely for that reason. But I can guarantee you, that portion of the electorate is so small, you could probably populate the town of Wasilla with them. This election is about race. We have to realize that our country is so fearful of race that it's embedded in every aspect of our being. The very Constitution itself had to be changed, because at its inception was a lack of clarity to even recognize the full humanity of blacks. I mean, we argue over immigration. We easily look to those who are new and strange and blame them for whatever our own failures are. We face a candidacy right now of a man who offers a youthful and educated view on the world and recoil to even the smallest corners of our minds with the words Muslim, terrorist, radical, black, all of it that sits on our collective bigotry like a heroin addict on our fear-riddled junkie minds. Now, I was recently sent an email of comparisons that I found funny that I wanted to share with you. Here's how it's titled. It's called Comparisons. I'm a little confused. Let me see if I have this straight. If you grow up in Hawaii, raised by your grandparents, you're exotic and different. But if you grow up in Alaska eating moose burgers, you're a quintessential American story. If your name is Barack, you're a radical, unpatriotic Muslim. If you name your kids Willow, Trig, and Track, you're a maverick. If you graduate from Harvard Law School, you're unstable. If you attend 5 different small colleges before graduating, you're well-grounded. If you spend 3 years as a brilliant community organizer, become the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, create a voter registration drive that registers 150,000 new voters, spend 12 years as a constitutional law professor, spend 8 years as a state senator, representing a district with over 750,000 people, become chairman of the state Senate Health and Human Services Committee, spend 4 years in the U.S. Senate representing a state of 13 million people while sponsoring 131 bills and serving on the Foreign Affairs, Environment, and Public Works and Veterans Affairs Administration Committee, you don't have any real leadership experience. If your total resume is local weather girl, 4 years on the city council and 6 years as the mayor of a town with less than 7,000 people, 20 months as the governor of state with only 650,000 people, then you're qualified to become the country's second highest ranking executive. If you've been married to the same woman for 19 years while raising 2 beautiful daughters, all within Protestant churches, you're not a real Christian. If you cheated on your wife with a rich heiress and left your disfigured wife and married the next heiress that came along the very next month, you're a Christian. If you teach responsible, age-appropriate sex education, including the proper use of birth control, you're eroding the fiber of society. If while governor you staunchly advocate abstinence only with no other option sex education in your state school system while your unwed teen daughter ends up pregnant, you're very responsible. If your wife is a Harvard graduate lawyer who gave up a position in a prestigious law firm to work for the betterment of her inner city community, then gave that up to raise a family, your family's values don't represent America's. If your husband is nicknamed the first dude with at least one DWI conviction and no college education, who didn't register to vote until age 25 and was once a member of a group that advocated the secession of Alaska from the U.S. of A., your family is extremely admirable. Come on. I mean, it's funny when you think about it. But it all comes down to ugly comparisons because Obama's black. Admit it, you know it's true, it's the big duh, I know you're going duh. I have to bring this up because recently I talked to a family member who told me that he was not comfortable voting for Obama because he felt that if Obama won, I kid you not, this just threw me for a loop, he felt it would give blacks too much power. I was floored by the statement since this man would claim to be a progressive. But I had to ask him, from what point of view can blacks have too much power or even be equal in anybody's eyes when statements like that exist in the world? That by its very nature, blacks can have little or no power when the larger collective views them that way. But what mattered to me most was that I knew he was a progressive, so I had to ask him what he wanted for the future, and then asked him if he would ever get any of those things in a McCain administration. Now, while he looked at me afterwards and said, good point, to this day, that fear, that uncertainty, and that unsaid prejudice that exists within each and every one of us will probably permeate his decision and his vote, or maybe even a lack thereof. This election is more than just a referendum on the past 8 years. It's more than just a referendum on what we want for the future. It's a statement of whether this country can grow past itself, past the fears that have strangled its growth for over 100 years. It's whether we can elect a man that will lead us after 8 failed years to a path that can help in some way restore, at least in bits and pieces, what we believe this country is. So yes, Barack Obama is black. But once you get past this obvious characteristic, ask yourself, or at least ask the people that you know don't feel comfortable in voting for him because, and they can't seem to put their finger on it, will he offer you the future you want? Will he lead this country in a manner you believe is best? Are you, are they, are all of us willing to look beyond skin color and the obvious and ugly rhetoric of those who would use this base and primal fear to play to our prejudice for the future that we all want? Because, believe me, the future of this country, its soul, and our struggle to grow beyond this fear do matter, because all of our futures are at stake. In the end, it is all about race, and until we get past this internal struggle, we will only continue down the path of an old, tired, and frustrated man and his VP candidate who has the IQ of a dead flashlight battery and is nothing more than an addle-pated puppet who calls upon the worst in her followers, who are nothing more than a bunch of vain, selfish, empty bigots. And yeah, I just quoted a line from Anthony Maine. But that's what we're being given. The world itself is going to hell in a handbasket. But what does it matter to you? He's black. Okay, it's time to pay the bills for this podcast, and here is this week's newest sponsor.
Paramount Studios, in conjunction with Fox News, brings you the next feel-great action movie of the year, Top Gun 2008, starring the original Maverick, John McCain, as, well, Maverick. Also starring Dick Cheney as Viper, George Bush as Iceman, Joe Lieberman as the base commander, and featuring Governor Sarah Palin as Moose. Gentlemen, Top Gun was created at TGCM, Electoral Combat Maneuvering, Presidential Politics. In case some of you are wondering who the best is, it's on that plaque of 43 other names. The best candidate in Israel from each party is up here with their name on it. So, do you think your name's going to be on that plaque? Yes, sir. Good. I like that in a candidate. Talk to me, Moose.
Roger, yeah, you betcha. I can see Russia from here.
You pals around with terrorists, my friends. I crack myself up.
So you needed help here?
With what, my friends?
Well, have you figured it out? Have you figured it out yet?
What's that, my friends?
Well, who the best pilot, you know, El Presidente is, because I ain't never been shot down, nor impeached or nothing. Because I ain't never been in combat. So.
No, my friend, I think I can figure that out on my own.
Yeah, I heard that about you. You like to work alone.
I'm Sarah Palin.
I'm the Maverick, my friend.
Oh, you're the Senator Pilot guy. My guy Todd is like a pilot.
No, a naval aviator. Damn it, don't you know anything?
Mayday, mayday. Mav's in trouble. The economy's in a flat spin. His poll numbers are being flushed out to sea.
do up on that stage, it's all about palling around, and also because of things like Obama being dangerous, don't you know?
I am dangerous. Oh, damn it. I have to pee again.
John, this is Joe. I'm telling you right now to land those accusations against Obama. That's an order.
Alt-Rider, you are instructed to land. Land immediately.
John, what you should have done was land and pick me as your VP. Your ego's writing checks your body can't cash. Did that sound threatening? I can do it again if it's not threatening.
Gentlemen, this election's about combat. There are no points in second place. On November 4th, go to your polling station and vote for the original and most dangerous mavericks around. John McCain, Sarah Palin, Top Gun 2008. This movie will be distributed direct to video and hidden in our collective mental closets.
Okay, well, it's that time of the podcast to give out the What a Weenie Award, and I do have one person who won the What a Weenie Award, but I also have a couple of runners-up. The first one goes to Newsweek magazine. Now, Newsweek magazine, about a couple of weeks ago, put out an issue of its magazine where Sarah Palin, her face, was pretty much the entire cover of Newsweek. Now, I can't even begin to tell you how horrifying this was for me. And it's not for any type of biased, progressive, liberal thing, if that's what you're thinking. Like, oh my God! No. For me, what was horrifying about this was that it exposed just about every nook and cranny on the woman's face. Every little pore, every little blackhead, every little indentation, line, wrinkle, and then to add on to it, her subtle mustache. Her mustache, which at that point looked bigger than mine. And at that moment, I realized that Newsweek stole something very precious from me. It stole that little part inside of me, that Republican id, that lightly lusted after her. And Newsweek stole it from me. Newsweek stole away my naughty librarian fantasy. Newsweek stole away my, it's like, aren't you a bad girl thing going on. Newsweek took that from me. And I'm really mad, and I'm a little choked up. No, I'm just kidding. But for taking away something primal and base, and just because I think it's silly to say, Newsweek was very close in getting the What a Weenie Award. But that wasn't good enough. The next person I thought of was Joe Wurlsbacher, who we've all come to know and love as Joe the Plumber. We all heard about him 20-some-odd times at the debates recently. Now, Joe Wurlsbacher, or Joe the Plumber, as we've all come to know him, he had the chance to ask Barack Obama a question regarding taxes under Barack Obama's tax plan. His question in particular dealt with if a business he was interested in buying, if it made over $250,000, was it going to be affected by Barack Obama's plan? Because as he read it, it was going to be. Now, what has become interesting about this is that, one, Mr. Wurlsbacher just started working for that place 5-6 years ago. He's nowhere even close to owning that business. And to let you know how unclose he is, all you have to do is read some of the news reports, which I'll put up online for the research links for Indirect Democracy, and you'll know that Mr. Wurlsbacher doesn't even have a license, a contractor's license, a plumbing license to do business. And that's, you know, it's not a thing about him not wanting to do his job. He can still do his job. But he cannot own that type of business and go around talking about himself being a licensed and bonded contractor in that state. He doesn't even have that license for it. I don't think he could even begin to own that business without at least being able to put that forward, you know, to have that license. And he doesn't even have that. The simple fact is that Mr. Wurlsbacher unfortunately encompasses a big part of what we believe, what we've all sort of subtly allowed ourselves to believe, which is, and this is two levels, it really comes down to the Horatio Alger thing, that we're all going to become rich overnight and that none of us wants to lose what we have. And that's common. That's what everybody has. The fiscal conservative part of me has that, because whenever a property tax bond issue comes up, I'm inclined to vote no against it automatically because I don't want my property taxes to go up.
I mean, we all have that within us. There's nothing wrong with that. But the belief that has become within us that automatically we become rich, whether or not it's the lottery, a dead relative, maybe a genie in a bottle someplace, it's just not going to come to pass. Obama's plan does help out the 95% of us, the rest of us who are out there who are just struggling to get by. And that's the important person. That's the important part to think about, really. That's what it comes down to. Because the other thing that came up during Mr. Wurlsbacher's statement to Senator Obama was that he was concerned about this redistribution of wealth. Well, to me, that's funny, and I bring this up for several reasons. One, he doesn't even have that money. The average mean income of a plumber where this man lives is about $47,000. The fact that his business is somehow going to start earning $250,000 automatically is, you know, of course, laughable. It'd be like any other business would have to grow to outstanding rates, and there's nothing wrong. That can happen in this country. But what kills me about that statement is that everybody talks about the redistribution of wealth, that fear that they're going to have, that their money's going to be taken away once they get rich. When the simple fact of the matter is that most of us are never going to see that type of money ever. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with having what you have and enjoying what you have. Face it. None of us are going to win the lottery. None of us have a dead relative that's come out of nowhere. And none of us are going to find that genie in a bottle. And that's okay. That's the lives we have. And there's nothing wrong with having those lives. But what we have allowed ourselves to believe, what we have been bullshitted into believing, is that the redistribution of wealth is going to occur. And I say going to occur because they make it seem like it's this thing that might happen. Well, guess what, folks? It's already happening. Difference is, the redistribution isn't going from the top down. It's happening from the bottom up. Look at the profits that are being made by oil companies throughout the world. Tens of billions of dollars a quarter, billions more per year. That's money coming from you and I. Look at the amount of money that CEOs make. The average cost, 350 times more than what the average worker makes. That's money that is going from the bottom up. Tax breaks given to corporations that don't need them. Subsidies that are given to businesses like tobacco that just don't need them. We are talking about the redistribution of wealth. Our tax dollars, so far as even recently, $1 trillion for the banking industry to be socialized because they have failed. Our money, your money, good taxpayer money given to companies that don't even pay their taxes. They hide them in loopholes and in little post office boxes on the Cayman Islands. We all worry about this so-called redistribution of wealth. Guess what? Already happening to you right now. The redistribution of wealth, it's going up, folks. So anytime somebody comes at you with one of those little lines about socialism and how wealth's going to be distributed back to the people, hey, guess what? All we're asking for is fair play. That we get to keep the money that we earn too. Because Lord knows it's already leaving us by the tens of billions. So that's part two, is why I think he would be a runner-up for the What a Weenie Award. But the real winner of the What a Weenie Award goes to, and this one's a long time coming, Senator John Sidney McCain. And I have to give this to him on several reasons. One of them, it's just simple, straight out, it's been this campaign. I said a long time ago that I asked the question, what is it like to walk around without that extra weight he calls a soul? I saw back then what we have all gotten to see in larger numbers. And I'm not trying to say how great I am. What I'm saying is that we have witnessed the loss of this man's integrity on so many different levels that I don't even think John McCain recognizes himself anymore. And that is really the sad point of this. Now, maybe back in 2000, the person that we think of as John McCain didn't really exist. Maybe he was a media fabrication as well. But I tell you this as a certainty. The gentleman who ran back in 2000 would have made a better candidate and a much more interesting candidate to watch than this person that is running right now. Because this person who is running has given up everything that was once his honor and integrity to win a prize. Nothing more, nothing less. It's all about winning the prize, and the prize is the presidency. All you have to do is look how this campaign has been run. He has flip-flopped on every major issue he has stood for, whether it comes to supporting tax cuts that he didn't believe in when the war first started, whether or not it has to do with torture and its uses, whether or not it has to deal with any of the bills that he has been such a maverick on that he's claimed that he fought for. The McCain-Feingold bill, the Kennedy-McCain immigration bill, things that he doesn't even want to associate himself with. He claims to be a Republican and a conservative, yet calls himself a maverick and doesn't even mention the president's name, wants nothing to do with him, won't even really mention, at times, the word Republican at his own conventions. There's something wrong that is going on with the McCain campaign, and it has to be stated, because this is about honor and integrity, and it also, yes, has to do with judgment, because right now, they are putting into you, and this is what kills me about everything that goes on. He talks about judgment and having the judgment to be president, yet when one of the worst economic crises hits this country, the man can't even keep the subtle judgment to know what to do. He is erratic. He is all over the place. And it's that lack of judgment that should make you worry. Even if you're a Republican, you should ask yourself, if this man can't even keep a steady hand as to what he's going to do, what he's going to believe, and how he's going to handle a situation, then you have to ask yourself, is he steady enough to be president? And one of the big no's of that question is his pick of Governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential candidate. Now, you can talk about executive experience all you want. Being a mayor, governor, that's fine. But you also have to look at the things and the policies and the people that she has associated herself with as well. And as well, to say to yourself, if she had that experience, if she had that type of ability to be in charge and to handle a situation when it came up, then why is it that they have canceled all media interaction with her for the last month of this campaign? And why is it when John McCain had to put a halt in his own campaign, suspend it, to suspend his own campaign to go work on the economic crisis, why couldn't he just say, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, I need to go back to Washington. I have to work with my fellow legislators on this economic crisis. It's important. But during that time, Sarah's going to take care of everything. That's how much faith I have in her. She's going to be fine. She's going to take care of everything. No, he couldn't say that because he knew that she couldn't do it, that she wasn't up to the task. And even when it came time for the final Couric interview, he had to sit by her and hold her hand to make sure it went well on a day that he supposedly was headed back to Washington to handle the economic crisis. If he couldn't trust her enough to handle that few days that he needed to be gone, how is it we're supposed to trust her as president if something should happen to him? And when it comes to the point of judgment, shouldn't we be allowed to ask about her judgment and the people that she associates herself with and how she has handled herself as a governor? Now, it's very easy to look at the Troopergate issue and say, wow, okay, she abused her power. But she didn't illegally abuse her power in the fact that she had the right to fire that man. That's fine. But to go on the air afterwards and completely disregard any of it and say that she was completely vindicated goes beyond any credulity that anybody could ever give her. And you have to say to yourself, wow, where's her judgment in that? Why is it that she just can't say, we overstepped the line, we did it because of this? Simple honesty at times can win people over very quickly. I felt that this man, my ex-brother-in-law, did not deserve to be a police officer. This person wasn't handling it well, and I felt that his judgment on this was tantamount to insubordination, or showed that I was never going to have a good working relationship with him, or, you know what, his decisions in the past on this issue and any other issue just showed he wasn't ready to be my public safety commissioner. She couldn't say that. Instead, she went, well, I was completely vindicated, and that is disgusting, because it shows that she can't even recognize the lie when it's happening. But the other issue is that while they have bombarded the American people with the past associations of Barack Obama and have allowed people to go out there and call him a terrorist and to say kill him and all the other issues, in fact, let me play this for you real quick.
Everybody wants Mary Hussein Obama. Yay, Mary!
Yay, Mary!
Mary Hussein Obama!
Canada!
We're back to Kenya.
The only difference between a bomb and a song is a PS!
Where is he?
Not a cross-section of America in his cabinet. It's going to be Al Sharpton,
hey, boys,
Reverend Wright,
boys.
Jesse Jackson.
Who are the terrorists?
Ayers! Obama, Ayers! Connection! What more do you have to say?
Okay, Hitler was a socialist too!
Iraqis for Obama! Get a job!
These are the supporters and people that they look to. You have to ask yourself about the judgment of allowing people like that to support you. I mean, that's really awful. And, of course, you can't control your supporters, but you can tell them to quell it down. But the other thing that bothers is when it comes to the subject of judgment, everybody builds this around because of their beliefs that they say that they can't trust Barack Obama, and they won't trust him because of his associations with Bill Ayers and Jeremiah Wright, because of what they say and how much they claim to hate America. And they say that that is a call about judgment, and therefore he shouldn't be president. Well, what about Sarah Palin and the people that she has associated herself with? If you just look at Paul Vogler and the Alaska Independence Party, this is a party in which the founder, Paul Vogler, has stated his complete and utter contempt and hatred for the United States. And even this year, the Alaska Independence Party put forth in its platform language that they wanted to introduce into the Alaska State Constitution about seceding from the United States of America. There is nothing more America-hating than saying you don't want to be part of this country anymore. And these aren't the statements and actions of people 40 years ago when Sarah Palin was a zygote or when Barack Obama was AIDS. We are talking about the actions and statements of people now. We are talking about the actions and statements of people today, because Sarah Palin spoke at their convention in 2008. That isn't 40 years ago. That isn't 10 years ago like Barack Obama with Bill Ayers. We are talking about actions now. And that calls into question Sarah Palin's judgment. It also calls into question her judgment when she was mayor, that she tried to put onto her city council a member of the Alaskan Independence Party because of what they did for her politically. These are not associations that have ended or in which she had just a light affiliation with somebody. We are talking about people that got her into her position of power as mayor and to which she even went to spoke for just this year. A person in which her own husband is affiliated with these people. That should call into question her own judgments, but we don't do that. We call into question the judgment through the continued statements of the McCain campaign of Senator Obama for affiliations with people who did things when he was 8 years old. And that's the sad thing of it. Because at one time, maybe there was an honorable man, maybe, called John McCain. But that man has given up everything that he ever thought was good and believed in, destroyed his very own legacy for one thing. Not for country, not for pride, not for a belief and love of everything that he thinks this country can be, but for the prize. Now, I know a lot of people say that's subjective, and whoa, how can you go that far? But when somebody gives up that much of their personality, that much of their character, that much of their own very integrity, for one goal, it's not hard to imagine why they would. It's about the prize, it's about the power. Nothing else, nothing less, nothing more. For that, for running a campaign that would shame
any decent common person, for going against everything you've ever believed in, and for picking somebody so unqualified to be president that you couldn't even trust them to run your campaign when you had to go back to Washington. You, sir, Senator McCain, are the winner of this What a Weenie Award. Well, I'd like to thank you all for listening. This was podcast number 32 of Indirect Democracy. Let's see, I would like to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find their music at www.megaphonemusic.net or at their MySpace account, which is myspace.com/megaphone. You can also find their music through iTunes, or you can find the links for them at the Favorite Links section at the homepage for Indirect Democracy. The movie clips that you heard earlier are from Head of State with Chris Rock and Bullworth with Warren Beatty, which are two fun political movies to watch. They're worth watching as the upcoming election, well, as our election season starts to wind down. But before I end this podcast, I would like to encourage you to vote. It's a very simple thing, I know. But get out there, get active, and vote. If you can find some way to be involved with the voting booths, if you can volunteer your time, do so. If there's still time you want to volunteer to a campaign, you still have time. If you want to just donate $5 to anybody's campaign, please do so. But get out there and vote. I know a lot of people who think their vote doesn't matter, that they have no influence in all this is how it's going to go. All I have to do is just ask you to remind yourself that back in 2000, the difference between history, and I'm not saying that lightly, I'm saying how history would have been changed, was 527 people. 527 people decided the presidency. 527 people are less than the amount of people that represent us in the combined House of Representatives and the Senate. And that's the difference that you can make. Get out there and vote, because it is the one precious right. It is the only one time that we get to participate in a national election. And trust me when I say it matters. A lot of people right now are going to fill your heads with, oh, it doesn't matter, they're going to steal it, they're going to do anything. You know what? If you want to avoid that, work the booths, work with any type of election protection program, find a way to get yourself involved if it matters that much. And if the least you want to do is to go there and just stand in that booth and punch the little paper, write the little dots, press the button on the computer screen, whatever format it comes in, it is your voice, it is your vote, and it matters. So get out there and vote. But until that time, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to listen. If you have any questions, you can write me at david@indirectdemocracy.com. But until that time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and bye for now.
Vice President Lewis, I am an amateur. When it comes to creating so many enemies that we need billions of dollars to protect ourselves, yes, I'm an amateur. When it comes to paying farmers not to grow food while people in this country starve every day, yes, I'm an amateur. When it comes to creating a drug policy that makes crack and heroin cheaper than asthma and AIDS medicine, yes, I'm an amateur. But there's nothing wrong with being an amateur. The people that started the Underground Railroad were amateurs. Martin Luther King was an amateur. Have you ever been to amateur night at the Apollo? Some of the best talent in the world was there. James Brown, Luther Vandross, Rockwell, the Crown Heights Affair, Hall & Oates, the Fat Boys, Ron Bass. But you wouldn't know nothing about that. Why? Because when it comes to judging talent and potential, you, my friend, are an amateur.
I believe the alderman is over his time.
No, you know, you had 8 years to talk. Now's my turn. I'm going to get mine. I'm getting mine.
Ladies and gentlemen, hold your applause, please.
How can you help the poor if you've never been poor? How can you stop crime if you don't know no criminals? How can you make drug policy if you never smoked the chronic? How can you do that? Just a nickel bag. I'm a real American. I've been high. I've been robbed. I've been broke. My credit is horrible. They won't even take my cash. Now, you're always talking about God bless America and no place else. But isn't it obvious that God has blessed America? America is the richest, most powerful nation on earth. If America was a woman, America would be a big titty woman. And everybody loves a big titty woman. So in closing, I like to say, you are full of shit. God bless America and no place else. How about God bless Haiti? How about God bless Africa? How about God bless Jamaica? I'm not talking about Jamaica, the beach, try y'all up. I'm talking about stabbing Jamaica. That's what I'm talking about. So tonight, I want to say God bless America and everybody else. The whole world. God bless you. I'm Maze Gilliam, and I'm running for President of the United States of America. Yeah.